The Jargon Crusade, a Nietzsche masterclass. Now, a very serious and epic series needs to begin with very serious and epic topics. So we're going to talk about a film called 21 Jump Street with Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. The premise of this masterpiece is that Channing Tatum, when he's in high school, he's this cool Chad and Jonah's a loser. But then they go to the police force, and 10 years later, they are assigned a job to find drugs in a school. So they go undercover as students. And what actually happens is now the culture has changed so radically that Channing Tatum is now the low status beta and Jonah Hill's the high status dude. Because now, you know, what is cool is to be a nerd. What is cool is to be interesting and more submissive. Whereas what is beta is to be, you know, a try-hard jock. That's not cool anymore. The hipsters have won. And it's a brilliant, brilliant premise. It's a very funny film. I recommend you go watch it. I don't recommend many films, and especially not these sort of mainstream ones. But this genuinely was good. I liked it. And it is Nietzschean. they were definitely reading. They were reading Nietzsche all night when they're doing it. I know. In seriousness, they probably weren't. What seemed to have been going on with this is that these people, these scriptwriters, they were definitely observing, doing what Nietzsche said. They were definitely observing what was happening around them. Because you see, Nietzsche, all his theories came, it seems, from correct observations. That was the foundation towards his great thoughts. And so when he says to you, here's my three-step program towards developing your mind, that's why it begins with observation. If you want to do this, you must be an observer. And so what he saw, what these scriptwriters saw, is that there's been a radical shift in culture the last while. And you know, this doesn't end here. It wasn't 2010, everything was normal, and now things are weird. This has been gradually happening for 50 years, Nietzsche would propose, for thousands of years. And this is the most important idea that you can ever, ever digest. The idea that what is normal, what is status quo right now, is not in any way reasonable, is not in any way the God-given exact way to do things, you know? 50 years ago, things were radically different. We lived in this highly conservative society by our standards. But in some sense, the Nietzscheans and the Julius Evolas would look at 1950 society and think of it as this liberal, far-left, radical break from radical traditionalism before the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment's 500 years old. And of course, if you were looking from Nietzsche's perspective, Rome, ancient Rome, was far more of a status quo, whereas the break through Christianity that we've descended into for the last 2,000 years, that's the radical culture change. And this is all incredibly shocking stuff when you actually digest it. It completely blows. It's like Guy Fawkes running in. Nietzsche's like this little Guy Fawkes running in with these intellectual ideas, putting dynamite all under your premonitions and detonating it. And you know, I come from the school of thought of Jordan B. Peterson. And I do love him. I think he's a juicy boyo. But he does this interesting thing where he is trying to enforce the assertion that the current status quo, the normie vision, is correct. You know, the West got it right, as he says. And this is quite problematic, because then what he starts to frame as evil, if you wish, his shadow, is the bloody postmodernist neo-Marxists. And what's annoying about that, what's really frustrating about that, is that it's not like they're wrong. When you observe, like Nietzsche's saying, you start to see what these bloody postmodernist neo-Marxists were talking about, and you realize that Jordan, in his brilliance, may have been a little bit off on this point, and this is what we're going to explore. And so, in order to kind of drill this home. I'm going to try to start from where we are instead of doing what I would have a tendency to do, which is be like, here's an obscure chapter from Nietzsche. Let's start talking about our reality, you know, like this cultural shift as it's happened. So when I was in the 2010s and I was around in 2012, you know, when they thought the world was going to end and all this, maybe it did, who knows? I was, you know, I'd be on Facebook, and this is when Facebook, back when Facebook was just relatively fresh, although it was reaching its dominance at this point, and you'd see these memes pop up. And I got into left-wing stuff, and I got into the anarchists and all this, and these were the sort of dissidents, if you will, and they were rebelling against, you know, conservative America, and that was the sort of culture at the time. It was rebelling against the conservative status quo, and going towards this new radical anonymous way of being, where everybody's like sort of free and anarchist and fuck the system and fuck the powers and all that. And what's so interesting about this is the one of the main assertions that these people would make is that the American project, the goal of America, is to dominate, like, since the Cold War. This is all really hard stuff to get your head around, but basically the effort of America outside of its military conquest is to actually culturally dominate the world. America is the cultural hegemon of the world. It's like the way that everybody in Europe after Rome fell spoke Latin, because Rome dominated the culture so much. America is doing something quite similar now. It's this cultural hegemony. It's this cultural domination. And what does that exactly mean? Well, a lot of the anarchists I get involved with, you know, they would always say this sarcastic stuff like, America will invade your country and install a McDonald's in place of your monarch. And then they will send their hordes of fat and cargo shorts wearing tourists over to visit you. And these guys would visit and walk around and like look at all your stuff and sleep in your hotels. And, you know, imagine in like just some Cambodia or something like that. These guys are these fat Americans just walking around and consuming your homeland, you know, and in the sense that they go to take the photos, they put themselves there, and then they don't even eat your food. They make sure that if you're going to feed them the food, it has to be salted and really fatty and Americanized. They don't want your pleb food. They want their American version of it. And then they'll go to McDonald's when they get sick of it. And even my dad, I remember talking to my dad, and he went to Hong Kong, and he said that he ate the food there for a while and he liked it, and he still likes Asian food, but at some point he just kind of snapped and he just went to McDonald's because he just wanted something that he felt safe with. He felt he knew, you know, he felt comfortable with, something that's not different. And there's a litany of things that we can talk about with this that are so interesting, but the most important one is to understand this cultural imposition, this cultural crushing of the world, and then of course the fact that this was a left-wing movement and now it's starting to turn into a sort of right-wing position, if you will, and showing us that the culture is radically changing. Political stuff is very, very unreliable because, you know, we're shifting all over the place, and there's a lot of confusion. It's really hard to make sense of all this stuff. And then even with that thing about my dad, you know, my dad saying, oh, I just went to McDonald's so I had something I knew. Like, my dad's an Irish European man. And so it's amazing, it's scary actually, that his conception of comfortable and homely is an American produce, you know? He didn't go and look for Guinness, he didn't go to the local Irish bar in Hong Kong, because he's been Americanized, showing that the Europeans most certainly have fallen victim to this a massive amount. And so what we start to see is that we're in a really interesting place. This is the, you know, the global homogenized way of seeing the world. Maybe that's the term for milk, not unity. Well, you know what I'm saying. This idea that we're all stuck in the same place. And what does this actually feel like on the ground, you know? Well, it's actually a kind of bleak way of living. It's not terrible, but it's not great either. Like, we're well fed. We have everything. Everybody gets to go to college and all that. But there's this there's this very problematic reality about things, in that, well, it's the death of God thing, you know? We've materialized everything. The American ideal is capitalism, and the ideal behind capitalism is that basically everything is up for sale. Again, another left-wing critique that is interestingly not considered left-wing anymore. Now left-wing is weirdly pro-capitalist, it seems, in some sense. It's kind of hard to get your head around this stuff, I'll admit. And this chaos is what we're trying to brush out of the way so we can see the truth. But basically, this idea that capitalism puts the world up for sale, and what that does is that eventually destroys the ability for you to connect with the world, for you to sacralize the world, for you to
to believe in the world, for you to care about the world, for you to have any meaning. I know Jordan Peterson talks about the meaning crisis, and maybe, but he's also a capitalist, he says, an individualist. But what if, God forbid, one of the biggest obstacles is this capitalism conception? It's very, very interesting. And so what I mean by this is that, you know, you don't go to church anymore. No one goes to church anymore. Church is bullshit. It's like some fake, you know, spiritual crap. Like, who cares about that? But then, of course, all your friends, I guaranteed, all your friends are yoga bitches, you know? They go to yoga and everybody sits down during yoga and does all these stretches. And then they all chant. Chant, 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 chant. They chant like, I don't know, whatever it is they do. The Om or something like this. And they do all these Eastern chants and they get really caught up in Hinduism. And you'll have some friends then. And yoga is so funny because they'll all show up to yoga with, like, you know, Starbucks coffee cups. And they'll get these mats, and all these mats will have the psychedelic 60s pattern on them, and you know, the sort of chakras written on them, and they'll sit down there and they'll get into this cult of their body, and they'll all chant together, and then they'll talk to each other, and they'll be like, oh, I can't wait to go to India, get some Instagram photos of me climbing on the mountain. They'll go to India, and then they'll try find an authentic guru, and of course this authentic guru will be will have a very, very thriving business, because they're a tourist guru who sits around and takes money off naive Westerners and teaches them yoga. And then of course they learn the yoga, they come back, and they sort of sprinkle in the spirituality, but that's all it is. It's just the cherry on top. No one actually believes most of these theses. And then they sort of get this materialized, consumable version of yoga. And this forms the literal foundation for most of us. Like, I got into yoga around about this time when I was an anarchist and all this. This is what I looked to, you know? This is what we all looked to. We were all such basic bitches. And it's still happening, you know? And you think about the kind of way that we live then is that, like, there's this unified culture that stretches all across Europe, and it's starting to stretch all across the world, which is this sort of yogized version of spirituality combined with this cynical, materialist, capitalist office job way of living. So you're in your 9-to-5 in that grind and sedentary lifestyle, you know, your glutes turn off because you're sitting down all day, you're hunched over, you're designing some app for some phone. Which is probably some type of, like, find your nearest yoga studio, or rate your yoga teacher, or find the best coffee app or something like that. And you're doing like UX design to make it all clean and quirky and beautiful and all this. And so you go to yoga because it's physical. It talks about nice things like, you know, if you just love hard enough, like, the world will be redeemed from all the hate that exists in the world and all the pain. And then, you know, you'll have these religious festivals where you'll go to them and they'll play this really intense techno music, and you'll just, like, knock back a load of soma, a load of the sacred chalice, you know, the baptismal water, the sacred wine. You'll knock back a load of MDMA or LSD or something like that, get fucking blazed out of your mind, and dance around in a Dionysian trance, and then go back into the routine. And in your local churches, when you go home and you turn on Netflix and you sit down at Netflix and you listen to, you know, the dreams of the culture, the stories, the sacred stories. And inside of that is all your values. Inside of those stories is what you should believe is right and wrong. And of course, like, the church is a hilarious parody in all those stories. So you think the church is stupid and full of pedophiles, basically a dogmatic ruling tradition full of pedophiles that was trying to keep you out. Now what we've got is this thing where, you know, you're free to choose what you're into. And so weirdly, because we're free to choose as individuals in this free market of capitalism where you can buy anything, we're free to choose this. What we all end up doing as a hulk, as a mass, is we all end up doing the exact same thing, chanting in yoga, working in some office job, designing some tech app, drinking Starbucks, going to festivals, and watching Netflix. And so as much as we wanted to believe that, because we've got this freedom going, that we've got these litany of choices that we're engaging in, instead we're actually probably more unipolar than we ever have. Like, this is probably 500 million people, maybe even close to 1 billion people, like, living this way in some sense. Okay, there are some pretty astounding stats, but you know what I mean? It's very, very high. Maybe it's not 1 billion. I don't know. I kind of feel silly saying that. We'll see. Maybe it is, though, if you factor in Australia and all that stuff. Steph is not good at stats. He's going to really quickly move on from this and pretend that didn't happen. And so, yeah, like, you know, your pilgrimages, I forgot to mention that, your pilgrimages is traveling to India, you know? That's what's going on. And this is... This is it. And when you go to school, that's the same religious teaching in some sense. It's the same. You're going through the monastery or, you know, whatever, the thing that baptizes you into the culture. Like, it's all the same prison. It's all the same routine. It's all the same stuff that's going on. And if you were to pull the brakes on all this and ask yourself, wait a second. That there's something weird about that. You know, like if I look at this, and you know what I'm saying is true, you see it all around you and you can observe it clearly. And if you look at that and then you do something radical and you zoom out from that, you detach yourself from that, you zoom out from it. Like, I know that yous all go over there, you're feckin' Buddhists and all that. Well, let's actually do some. Let's zoom out of that and take a look maybe just 100 years ago, even around about Nietzsche's time, you know, and try to think about their reality. So, like, we're doing the 21 Jump Street thing. So Channing Tatum has woken up and he's stuck in the schoolroom and everybody's being weird and calling him a beta, even though he's like four times the size of them all. And he zooms out and he thinks about 10 years ago when he was in high school and be like, what the hell was going on? I used to be a stud, man. What's after happening? Now I'm stuck hanging around with the rejects. What's going on? And so we do that and we look at this weird reality we've fallen into and we zoom out and we go back to 120 years ago, you know, in the Victorian era, and we look at the way that they saw the world and start to compare the differences, and we see this unbelievably radical change in value systems, in just the difference in the culture. It's incomprehensible the way that they thought. It's unbelievable, you know. And the thing is that it's difficult to do this, because what we will do is that we will impose judgments upon their way of thinking. Like, if we zoom into the Victorian thing, we're going to go with this assumption that they're all sexually frustrated, that they're all backwards. You know, that's the sort of statement, that they're boring and uncool and you know, the weird white people and all this stuff. And this is an obstacle towards us seeing what was actually going on and understanding and giving context to our reality. And allowing us to see, like, it's, if we go back and look at the Victorian era, we don't have to sort of say it's the best. Let's all rewind back to Victorian era. We just need to understand the difference. We need to be able to do that mental gymnastics. We need to be able to jump to this other place and visualize this other place. And this is hard for people. So this is what I'm interested in doing. And of course, when you realize this, when you actually do this, you're doing Nietzsche correct. Do some Nietzsche correct there, boy. When you're able to bounce to this other reality and really sit in it like an art, really reconstruct it properly, you start to develop this really powerful way of thinking. And so the ways that you can do this are many. You could do it in a litany of different ways. You could study scientific attitudes towards botany if you wanted, or, I don't know, technology and all this. But one of the most interesting ways is to look at words, look at concepts. And this was something Nietzsche, in some sense, pioneered in his book, The Genealogy of Morals. He looked at words and watched how they evolved. And we will talk about that a bit more later. But basically, if you look at the concepts that people hold as important, you start to see a lot about their minds. And what do I mean by that? Well, words are sort of, they seem pointless and empty. They don't seem like they matter that much. But then, of course, certain words have a huge amount of power. Huge amount of power. I would call it charge. It's like magic, you know? They have a lot of meaning. It's like the fact that there's 7 billion people in the world, but your girlfriend is extremely charged with meaning. And so, you know, if there's someone running around and they're like spanking every woman they see, you'll sort of be like, oh, I don't know about that boy. Or like, or maybe you'll be for it. I don't really know. But if they spank your girlfriend, you'll suddenly get extremely upset. And of course, she's just another woman as anyone else in the scheme of things. But for you, in your reality, in your paradigm, she is the most meaningful thing ever. And so I can tell a little bit about you based on what you have the most charged emotions for. And words are most certainly like this. What people care about the most dictates to us the shape of their mind in some sense. And so we can look at our current reality and look at what words are charged and explore them and this is the jargon that I'm talking about, and explore them and help us understand the way that we think. And if we go back to other times and do the same thing, it helps us to understand that they think, and then it shows us the power of words. Like right now, you would be very, very careful not to talk about race too much. Whereas in the Victorian era, if you read Nietzsche, if you read most of their works and whatnot, it was common to talk about race. It was table talk, you know, and they talk about lower races and higher races. They would just spit this stuff out at the dinner table. But if you turned around and said, God, I had some great sex last night, they'd be like, oh my God, what? That's very implied. How dare you? But if you said that stuff now, you know, you said that to your dad now, and he was like, Jesus, like, you know, kind of hold your tongue there a bit. He'd be like, oh, Dad, you're so stuck in the past. Grow up. Things are different nowadays, Dad. We're moving towards a different way of seeing things. And so we have an inverted taboo in some sense. And that's absolutely fascinating. Like, what conclusions are you supposed to draw from that? When you study the jargon, the charge given to each of these jargons, what conclusions are we supposed to draw? And if you look at our current paradigm, you know, people get caught up in like some of the silliest jargon. This is, you inspect all the jargon, left versus right. And as I just said, many positions I sort of have now were considered left wing a while ago, but some people would consider them right wing now. And this stuff doesn't even make that much sense anymore, you know? A lot of right-wingers are libertarians. Libertarian is tied to the idea of liberty. If you want to really talk about this stuff, you know, where did left-wing and right-wing, where did that jargon come from? Well, of course, during the French Revolution, you had a monarchy, absolute monarchy, motherfucker. And then you had the rising, essentially, freedom, fraternity, and equality movement that was coming up, the power of the people, the democracy, the mob, as Nietzsche said. And they were charging against the monarchy, against the divine right of kings, the sort of irrational power of the monarchy. And that's where you got left wing and right wing, because on the left hand side you had all these liberals, these people demanding democracy. And then on the right hand side you had the king, who was demanding absolute no ability for social mobility. You cannot be led by someone you elect. My family are the only people who can ever rule you. I am the king. I rule you. You cannot take your power from me. There is no way that you can have a decision about what to do. That is not possible. That's my position. Total illiberal. Total against all of these values that these people are throwing up. Whereas the left wingers then come up and say, we want to give the opportunity for someone in our entire population, anybody who has the talent to be able to rise up and take the throne. And that's where you get left wing versus right wing. But now right wing is libertarian, but you talk to a libertarian and they have all the same values as someone who was left wing back in France's time. This stuff has drifted. And in some sense, and this is a really important thing to remember, if your jargon is prone to drift, your jargon's probably not that good. This is what Nietzsche noticed when he talks about master morality, slave morality. He's trying to find a firm conceptualization for these things. Because the better your concepts are, the more resilient they will be to change, the more accurate they will be at perceiving reality, and then the more useful they are towards you acting in reality, towards you thinking. You've probably heard before, and I'm a very visual thinker, but I do like words, and you've probably heard someone say before that the words that you use dictate the way that you think. They dictate the boundaries of your mind. You'll know, if you ever read 1984, George Orwell's often talking about the idea that what's happening is they are trying to reduce the newspeak language, trying to reduce the language of 1984 down into the simplest way possible. They're trying to delete words so that people can only think in a very, very simplistic way. They're the jargonites. They're trying to master jargon and control the minds of the masses through restricting their language. And there's something definitely to this. And if you were to really do, quote unquote, intellectual work, this is what you would be doing. You'd be inspecting these concepts with vivid or aggressive scrutiny, but also a cool, distant, calm objectivity. you know? You'd be watching this stuff. And the one thing you're trying to understand here is that you project charge, you project judgment and energy into words. And what you're looking for is how people project that energy. And so your goal in order to do this right is you actually have to remove that energy from these things. You know? So what we're going to do is that we will be caught up in the spirit of our age, our zeitgeist, in our current religion. Our energy, our charge, our judgment will be projected on certain words. And in order for us to truly think for ourselves, to individuate, as they say, we need to pull that charge away from these concepts, observe this stuff like a Buddhist, coolly and coldly. And then maybe if we do a good enough job, but we can't force this, allow this charge to get reprojected back into concepts as we see them anew. This is sort of what Nietzsche does. You know, he wakes up in Germany. He detaches from his culture. He observes it. He sees through all the riddles of good and evil and all this crap. And he re-baptizes things as master and slave and all his various conceptions and Ubermensch and all this stuff. And then he injects his judgment and his charge into those new things. And that's why he writes with such fire and criticism and judgment and assertiveness, because he's done it well. And so he believes in his reason. And of course, we can do it too. And of course, not only can we do it, perhaps we must do it. If you've seen the film Fight Club, you know the famous lines where Tyler Durden walks around among these men and he says, "Our war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives." And of course, this was a statement which resonated incredibly with the people who watched it at the time. Even me, later on, years later, I watched this film and I loved it. I thought it was such a brilliant, poignant film, because that's what, you know, my middle class struggle felt like. And so this is where things start to get extremely interesting, because this group that we are, well, you know, Jordan Peterson moved us a lot. He moved us a lot by speaking to our spiritual war. He spoke to it. He said, "These are your problems." He talked to you about jargon. Jargon being like a very specialized version of jargon. You could call it dogma or bias, present in our neo-atheist world, where you would giggle at the silliness of Christ and God and the Bible and all that. But he, of course, re-injected the majesty, the mystery, the mystique, the profoundness into these topics, the meaning of the West, individualism. He re-baptized the jargon word, the West, as something glorious, something profound, something deep, something worth fighting for. Now, of course, this is so fascinating because obviously us boyos come across from this. He's answering this spiritual war. We're yearning for this spiritual war. But I think there's still a few steps we have not taken. I think there's a few things we need to know. And so with a jargon crusade, we would be doing what Jordan might have as his own shadow. Of all things, Jordan Peterson might be biased against the bloody postmodernist, as I've said before, and they might actually be the answer to this problem. And so what do I mean by that? Well, let's think about what they were doing. They were trying to criticize a hierarchy. They were trying to criticize a institution, a power structure. They were trying to overcome the Catholic Church, or the Church in general. But let's go with the Catholic Church, because it's the best, most powerful archetype. Now, in order for you to understand this, what they were trying to do, the bloody postmodernists, and this had been going on for a couple of hundred years at this point. This was not something they started in the 20th century. This has been something that was going on since the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment thinkers, the, shall we say, the liberal thinkers, they, and true liberal thinkers, like the 500-year-old liberal thinkers, they didn't like the church. They didn't like the jargon of the church. Why? Because jargon is power. And what the church does, and how this power works, is just the key towards understanding everything. Now, if you are a big fan of Christianity, if you like the West, you've come from the Jordan Peterson side of things, and you think it's awful what they did, you need to take a step back and just follow the thinking here. Okay? You need to understand the negative side of a priest. You need to give these people their steel man. So, what happens with the word sin? It is a magic spell. What? It is a magic spell for real. Think about what even the word spell means. That's a word for language. You spell out a word. And so a magic spell is the ability to throw words at things. Well, how is that power at all? Well, think about what human beings are, especially as a collective. You stick them all inside a herd like sheep, and they gather together. And they have a very, very basic herd mind, a very, very basic mob consciousness. Each individual responds to the more basic emotions. When you put all of the people together as one, you can abstract out their emotions and almost speak to their emotions. Now, what is the most dominant emotions they will have? Fear and the desire to fit in and be good together, to be together. Typical herd mentality. And all of us are subject to this. I'm no exception. I often fall for this stuff. I'm afraid of many things just because I'm told to. It's very hard to break out of this. True understanding of individualism would be to explore this a little bit more, but of course we don't talk about that too much. But nonetheless, understand this. And understand if you were a shaman sheep and you decided you wanted to lead these people because you're a good guy. What you would need to realize over time is that it's very hard to persuade them with complex philosophical talk like I'm doing. It's not really the most practical thing I'm up to here. So what you would realize is that you need to speak to their emotions. Speak to their fear. Say you're a shaman sheep, you're very smart and you can see in the distance further than any other sheep because you've got these massive sheep eyes. And you see a wolf. And all the other sheep are eating on the low ground where they're vulnerable. Well, you're going to need to say to them, oh my God, there's a wolf. We need to go up the high ground. But you've seen sheep before. They'll just all kind of sit at you chewing, being like, no, man, I don't want to. Or you're a weirdo. But of course, when you can scare one sheep, all the rest of the sheep will go. Or if you can scare a lot of them, you'll have this stampede up to the hill. And that will save them. And so the shaman sheep learns to speak the fear very quickly. He doesn't try to explain himself too much. He tries to do what is effective because his job is to lead, and leading often can mean not being an intellectual, let's put it that way. Or not sounding like one at the very least. And then on the flip side, you would turn around to all the sheep and you would reward them and be like, we're good sheep together and we're out here fighting against the wolves. Now, in society, things become even more complicated because, you know, you'll have this problem where wolves, as evolution evolved, wolves got very, very smart. You can imagine them like these sort of alpha, engineer wolves, genius wolves, techno wolves or something like that. And maybe half human wolves, werewolves. And so what they start to do is they start to get smart. They realize that it's very hard to just attack this herd because this shaman sheep has got very good eyesight. So what they start to do is they start to dress up as the other sheep. And so they go and they sneak into the herd. They're sitting in a hedge one day and they kind of just pop out alongside and they look like just another sheep. And everybody's like, oh, well, what? There you are. Hello, other sheep. And the sheep is like, yep. Oh, yeah, I'm definitely a sheep. Don't you worry about me. And then he eats one of the lambs, eats one of the babies. And everybody's shocked. How did that happen? Who ate the baby? It was a naughty, naughty wolf. And then eventually the shaman sheep, he realizes, oh my God, we've been infiltrated. And so what he'll have to do is he'll have to look and make all the other sheep turn on the secret sheep, the wolf sheep. So he'll have to find him and then he'll have to cast a spell because these sheep won't really be able to see it. Because it's like he looks normal like everybody else. They don't really have that much animosity towards him. But then the shaman sheep is going to have to paint a picture of him. He will look like a sheep on the surface, but what the shaman sheep is going to do is say, underneath his wool is a hairy body, an Irishman, a hairy body, sharp teeth. In his soul is a digestive system full of more acidic pH. No, he's probably not going to say that. But he'll start to paint a picture. who start to cast a picture. And the entire punchline, the entire cap to this picture is one simple piece of jargon: wolf. And so he'll paint all this, these pictures. He'll fill their minds with fear and animosity, and he'll evoke this charge out of them. And then he'll drop the category on top of this sheep. And then all the sheep will turn on that sheep and stampede him and kick the crap out of him if they could. And so now you start to see the power of words. Now, what happens if they kill off all the wolves? They become so successful at this. The shaman sheep is so good that he kills off all the wolves. And then there are no wolves left. Then what happens is there's other shaman sheep who think that they can do the shaman sheep's job better. Well, then what the shaman sheep might do in order to protect his position as the leader is he might start to paint a picture about these upstarts in order to get that category wolf popped on top of them so that all the other people in the flock turn against him. And of course, this is the weirdest version of ASMR you've probably ever heard, but I hope you see my point here. This is us getting into the deep psychology of humanity through understanding the power of categories, the power of jargon. If you can throw a piece of jargon on someone, you have an immense power, especially if that piece of jargon is attached to their fear. Do you understand? These are magic spells. Certain ideas, certain frequencies, certain energies are key towards power. If you can control someone's fear, you can control someone. If you control many people's fear, you have an immense amount of power. You have an army of people. And you don't have to do a thing with your hands. You can cast the spell and you won't even have to touch them. It's incredible when you think about it. It's like your nervous system has extended out to hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people. And this is a much more sophisticated way to wage power. A lot of people get into Nietzsche and they're like, oh, you know, steroids and become like an alpha male and go beat people up and all this. But of course, Nietzsche noted that, yes, those guys are essential. They are the excellent versions of beautiful health. And they are people we should idealize, certainly, but they are not the people who gain power. Because that type of power is impotent. What you see in history, especially in sophisticated civilizations, is sort of dumb warriors led by priests. Because these Brahmin castes, these intellectuals, these holders of the jargon control the minds of the warriors. The warriors become nothing more than orcs or golems for this type of project. And so the priest is the real problem. And so you can see this. You know the memes. The Catholic Church established itself as this incredible hierarchy that ruled over the entire fucking world at one point. And these litany of priests and this pope and all that, he could turn around at any point he wanted and paint someone as a sinner and ostracize them from the church, possibly even get them executed. He had that power. You know, these people could rile up a population so much that you could probably get someone executed. Think of the witches. Oh, they're demonic. They're possessed by Satan. That power is incomprehensible. Because that's the jargon that gets the fear. That's the same fear of the wolf. Evil, those deep, primal emotions. And of course, you build this feeling of we are together as a flock. You reward, like the way you pet a dog, you reward the sheep who obey you by saying, we're in this together. We talk about love. We all love each other. I love you. You love me. We all hug each other. We're all good. We all give ourselves up towards the greater ideal, which is the flock. We're all in this together. And of course, this becomes so interesting because you sort of get this pyramid, this hierarchy, as they notice. And, you know, Jordan Peterson says that hierarchies are good. Well, let's study hierarchies like the postmodernists did. And this is what they would see. They would see this dynamic of power and they would critique it. And we, of course, are being get mad at them for critiquing the Western power dynamics, but it's not fair. They are doing a justified and intelligent critique, which Nietzsche did as well. So you have at the bottom, this fear energy, this magic spell where you can get people murdered by casting them as satanic or evil or sinful. And then on the top, you have this incredible inverse of that power where you have just the most crazy thing of all, which is to say that there are this family of Germanic kings who have been chosen by God to rule you without question. Your question of their rule is sin. Incredible concept when you think about it. We look back at it now and we think that's insane that could even happen. But of course it did. And trust me, you would make a grave mistake to think that people were dumb back then. I guarantee you have a lot of mistakes in your thinking that history will look back on you and laugh. And so you can see this incredible hierarchy. The priests paint this idea of the kings as these divine, glorious people who deserve to be where they are. And you have your place in this society, and these priests will tell you about the wolves. And of course, some people didn't like this, because all institutions eventually get stale and corrupt for various reasons. And so a lot of people got upset with the priestly class. This is the Enlightenment. And that young shaman sheep, that shaman sheep that was challenging the alpha shaman sheep's power, of course, a lot of them got killed, a lot of them got ostracized, but eventually some of them started to cast magic spells. Eventually the main shaman sheep, he got lazy and cocky. The kings that he was protecting, you know, the big ram that he was protecting, got a bit arrogant and spat on the sheep. Eventually enough people got pissed off that one of these shaman sheep was able to cast a spell back. Because all you need is to be heard. And he cast a spell back on the shaman sheep, on the leader, on the top magician. And eventually, there's a breaking point, a tipping point. And what we start to form is a new hierarchy. Because what this upstart, this competitor, is creating a new pyramid, a new version of seeing the world in the minds of the sheep. And at the bottom of this, the sinful label is now not projected necessarily on the wolf, but the sinful label, because there are no wolves, the sinful label is now projected on the lying shaman sheep, the dogmatic, dishonest shaman sheep. And then, of course, what is good is these free thinkers, these new thinkers. And you get a new hierarchy. And this actually becomes the foundation for, well, what was the French Revolution? Do you understand what I'm saying here? For a couple of 100 years, maybe only 100 years, maybe only 50 years, This jargon was rearranged. The jargon was wrestled out of the hands of the priests, and they built a new hierarchy, a new spiritual tree of life, a new psychological way of seeing the world. And you think, well, this shit's trivial. Why does it matter? No, it's not. Because once they took away the divine right of kings and got that jargon of sinner and evil and lying and deceptive and wolf-like painted on the priests and the aristocrats, the French Revolution soon had those priests and aristocrats, those ones chosen by God, on their knees with a guillotine sitting over their head, looking down into a basket with their family members' heads staring into it. Tell me that's not power. And so these postmodernists, like Nietzsche and his ilk, would look at these examples I'm giving you here and suggest that these hierarchies are not as stable as you think. Now, much kudos to Jordan Peterson, but I hope you realize that the hierarchy he told you to support, or he supports, is actually the one that was wrestled from the priests. He's not supporting the divine right of kings. He's not supporting the monarchs. He's not supporting radical illiberalism. He's supporting the individualism and the fraternity and the freedom, the Enlightenment values. Because this transition out of that old hierarchy, that update, and it was a bloody update, it cost lives. It took intellectuals hundreds of years to wrestle that power from the priests, is actually what we would consider now our paradigm. Actually, as I said, what's so strange about it is we shifted into this new hierarchy. It consolidated into its new strange way of doing things, which was, you know, the libertarian West. And of course, now you see that we're going through the same process. These people who, as I said, were left-wingers back in the day, upstarts against the old order, have now become the old order, and there's a new conception forming that is struggling to take power from them. There's an attempt to change the jargon again. What I need you to see, and this is why I think Jordan Peterson may have been very incorrect to think this way, what I need you to see is how this is like a snake shedding its skin. Each step forward in the hierarchy takes hundreds of years, takes these huge jargon wars followed by actual bloodshed. And then we are in a new paradigm. And then this paradigm seems like the radical new fresh thing, but of course over time it ages, becomes stale, becomes the old shaman, begins lying, begins having contradictions, and then it gets assaulted. And then a new transition is attempted. And this is some eternal process. Now I hope you understand that Nietzsche saw this. And so You do understand that each of these transitions involved wrestling jargon free from the old order and possessing the jargon yourself. You needed to wrestle away from Rome the idea that good was to be a martial, honest Roman citizen, and bad was to be a essentially non-citizen. And you needed to wrestle that from them and switch good into being a member of the Christian community and bad to be a dogmatic conservative Roman. Just like what happened in the French Revolution then, that good Christian being was wrestled away and turned into the scientific, sort of mildly atheist intellectual. The authoritative priest was turned into the actual personification of evil, the ignorant backwards priest, the thing holding us back from quote-unquote enlightenment. And what we see is that this idea of good and evil, which to us seems obvious, that there is a good and evil, when you look at history, when you have a historical sense, when you explore it honestly, you see that there's absolutely no grounding to these words at all. They constantly shift. It's extremely relative. Now, perhaps there is something to them deeply, if you explore them properly, but on a surface level, no, they are very unreliable. And as I said, if we were to do this well, don't we deconstruct these words, find what is true, find what is solid, reliable, 100% stone to build a foundation upon, and then reconstruct these words, rebaptize these words. This is what a jargon crusade would be all about. But of course, this is difficult to do. And of course, this is something we counter-signal Nietzsche for being a postmodernist, but he points out that as much as you don't like that this is the truth, this is how things work. And you would be very, very arrogant to call reality evil, saying that I don't want to explore this because it doesn't suit what I've been told about reality, even though it does seem to be reality. This evidence is not trivial. This evidence is extremely easy to access. You just have to open up the various stories from history that are well established, how these transitions of power happened. The divine right of kings was a thing. Now, the reason why the jargon crusade matters for us is because that spiritual crisis, that meaning crisis, is actually a signal that something is wrong. That's a very honest signal. I always say you can trust your emotions almost beyond anything else, as long as you understand how to interpret them. And if you look at nihilism, you look at that struggle with meaning, well, what's that basically saying to you is that this world around me is not charged. I have this need inside me to instinctively almost fear or distrust something, but I don't see anything in the world that makes sense to fight against. There is no evil. I have this need inside me to believe that I'm part of something greater, to be a part of the great community, the flock. But I look around me and I don't see anything because my jargon has died. My jargon is unsuccessful. My jargon has failed. And of course, it's not trivial that, like the Enlightenment becoming the thing, the rising counter-movement towards the old order, that we have right now people rising up and declaring that they're woke. Same concept. They've woken up to the new way to baptize jargon. And you can run around and in this sort of pathetic paradigm and give out to these people who are woke for, you know, being the real racists and all this stuff and being, you know, not being fair and being hypocritical. But like, what alternative have you got to ask them to rewind history back 567 years to a time that you barely only understand through your imagination, through your, you know, idealized nostalgic energy about? You castigate people like Foucault as being a postmodernist without understanding that he has a huge amount of historical context to back up what he says. He's not an idiot. You don't have to like his conclusions. I'm not sure I do like most of his conclusions, but his method is fantastic. And if you are not able to entertain something you disagree with, what the fuck are you doing here anyway? What type of LARP is this, you know? And so, as Nietzsche would often say, he would often start books and passages with, "We Europeans, we Hyperboreans, we Northern Europeans, we need to look ourselves in the eye and understand what we're doing here. What's going on here? You need to understand what Nietzsche was trying to do." You see, Nietzsche is not someone you can casually dismiss because Jordan Peterson or Jung said he was mad or silly and all that. It doesn't matter. He was correct. Everything we've just talked about here, he got down to a nail. I know you don't like moral relativism. I know you don't like nihilism. But Nietzsche didn't invent these things. He observed these things. He described these things. He said, "I'm sorry, my friend, but it's happening again. We're going through the transition point. And it's going to be extremely strange because of the rising of super technology. Something big is happening." He pointed to the 20th century, the 21st century, possibly even the 22nd century, as this 200, 300, 400 year wrestling we're going to have as we essentially move past the concept of God. Now, what does that mean? Do we rebaptize a new God? I know the Christians get mad about this. I'm sorry. He's just saying that this old way that we saw God is definitely going to change. And the evidence now has stacked. There's no way around saying that he just got that right. That is so true. Look at the vast majority of people. And you might think he was attacking God. Look at what the vast majority of people are doing with the word God. They're turning him into a sort of neo-world religion God who loves everybody and who tolerates everything. God is getting rebaptized. God is this thing that the church got wrong, and he's not even really in the Bible anymore. It's something that we create in our own minds at this point. And, you know, this is tying with this immense nihilism, these immense problems that are going on. Well, how about we face this with sincerity, with cool objectivity, with the rationalism that people try to talk about so much, that they accuse Nietzsche of not having? Why don't we display this? Why don't we take a step back, remove our emotions from the situation? Look, just look at what's going on. See that these relative fluxes of hierarchies and this power of jargon as a magic spell and the transistory nature of jargon, often the fundamental power usage of jargon that lies beneath it, a lot more than truth. And understand that Nietzsche's sitting there at this bridge and saying, "Guys, Europeans, we've gotten dogmatic. We're in the position that the Catholics were in before the French Revolution. We've gotten stiff, stale, and old. We're the old guard. If we want to make it through the next 300 years, we need to adapt. We need to be ready for radical change." So what you get, and this is going to turn to a tirade against the conservatives, what you get against with these conservative types is that they want to hold the old order together. But of course, that never worked. Oh, you want to make everything like Christianity? Well, I'm sorry, but Christianity dominated Rome precisely because it wasn't willing to, it was fresh, it was new, it wasn't willing to remain the same. That happened to Christianity with the French Revolution. It's getting even worse now with Richard Dawkins. So what do you do? You can't put a Band-Aid over a broken leg. What do you do? Why can't we just sit down and look at the actual problem as it is and then adapt to that? Why do we have to cast all these judgments on it? Why do we want the problem to be something that we understand? Why do we create this weird prestige around it that Nietzsche's going to make you all nasty and scary and mean? Would you rather go extinct and lose and become an irrelevant second-class people? Or would you rather actually achieve something? Would you rather actually, you know, reestablish the energy that created that great civilization you're always talking about? Or do you want to be the ones known as the people who let it go because they're too spiritually weak? No. They were too stubborn. Yes, that's the one. They knew everything. And you know, that's a very old story. If you're to talk cynically, if you want to talk pessimistic, actually understand that history teaches us that humans just make these mistakes because they're arrogant and stubborn. The old order always thinks that it knows what's going on, and it convinces itself and it says, I know exactly what's happening. These upstarts are idiots. We're going to be fine until they're shoved face down and the axe is raised above their head. And this concept from Nietzsche that everyone has heard of, the Apollo versus Dionysus energy, is actually the brilliant key towards understanding this. Apollo is the beautiful, idealistic, up-in-the-air, heady, high-brow, almost nearly snotty way of seeing the world. The way you think you're above everything, whereas Dionysus is the meaty, in-the-hips, energetic, feeling your way. You've almost got your eyes closed. You're so drunk. You're feeling your way around the room. You're feeling your way around the world. And so think about what has happened in our period of history. We've idealized. We're going to go through this bottleneck, this 200-year death of God, nihilistic, crazy bottleneck, this postmodern madness. We're going to go through this. It's going to happen. You can't go back. It's going to happen. The only way past is through. And we are stuck in this traditionalist nonsense where we're trying to say to ourselves, oh, well, the 19th century will happen again. Oh, it'll just be, you know, we'll start listening to classical music again and it'll all go away. And we'll just be better. We'll be more moral than everyone else. And we'll speak with this upper brow and we won't try understand things. We sound like Antoinette saying, let them eat cake. You understand? Do you understand? Of course, Nietzsche was proven right. Like all this idealism, all this uprightness, all this nonsense about honor and the past and all that stuff, it was crushed mercilessly in World War I. The understanding of what politics and history and war and all that stuff, it was gone. When you had millions of men pointlessly shoved into a trench over borders by a warring family, that was the last credence, the last dignity, the last respect that you could give to that old order. The expenditure of life for what, really? Some weird political empires? It was done. It was over. For these ideal abstractions, borders. That was the finishing of that. And Nietzsche warned, and it happened. Because as we said, you can warn all you want, but people won't listen. Well, maybe you can, you know, try individuate yourself and change your little corner of the world by doing this, by actually mastering your mind, by mastering your jargon. Because perhaps the way forward is not this ideal. This is how things should be. Things shouldn't be relative. Things shouldn't be postmodern. We should go back to loving the West. People should be better. People shouldn't be anarchists. That's bad. That's mean. We'll just call them out on their hypocrisy and they'll listen to us because we'll use ideas. Or why don't we get in touch with reality and feel it? Think of those words. Get in touch with reality. Feel our way through the next 100 years, 200 years. Feel our way through this chaos, because this is what it is. Nietzsche often complained about Germans specifically, almost as a symbol of Europeanness, because I guess they are. They're one of the core people of Europe, if not the prime core of Europe. And he blamed them always of this Apollyonism and this lack of patience, this romanticism. They couldn't just get down dirty. They couldn't stick their head in the mud and feel their way through problems. Like, what are we evolving into? What are we moving towards? What is this world turning into?
Are we going to stand around and say, oh, we should have conservative values, we should protect the West, you should be libertarian, not liberal, you should want equality, but like only of outcome, not of this? Are we going to go around and do that while everybody listening to these weird ideals digests themselves into the last man, turns themselves into, you know, a fat blob consumer who plugs themselves up to some type of artificial intelligence virtual reality headset, sucks the world up and then sits there like some type of tub of ice cream and just ends the human race as this blob, when hopefully the Muslims kind of say, all right, fuck this, I'm going to take over these decrepit, degenerating empires and establish some type of concept of virtue upon them. Is that what we're going to do? We're going to stick with our ideals even if they drive us into the mud? Or are we going to challenge them? Are we going to actually look at what's going on? Are we going to say to ourselves, oh God, I wish things were better. I wish I was in the past. I wish and the people were nicer. I wish that things weren't so confusing. Or are we going to engage with our reality? Are we going to look at the words, the entire conceptual sphere that we're juggling in our hands and say, can we really trust this? Are we so ignorant to think that our little flicker in history got absolutely every value right, or even a majority right, and we've no reason to question every ounce of jargon in our hands to see what's actually going on? You see, you don't have a conception for how big history is, how massive transitions can be, how obscure things can be, because if you're not asking the right questions. The fall of Rome led to the rise of the Germanic kings. The Germanic kings lasted in that position for nearly 1900 years, nearly 2000 years, 2 millennia of absolute authority over Europe and eventually over nearly the whole world. And we are going through a transition point. And as Marx, naughty Marx noted, and as Nietzsche himself noted, there's going to be this rising of a new class, a new rulership. And of course, we want to understand what that process is. And what does that process mean? That is the shaman upstart sheep taking out the old sheep. That's a new way of seeing things. And if we're just going to unconsciously let that happen, we're going to fail. We're going to stick to these values that might destroy us, this jargon that might put us in a mental prison that will have us fall. Yes, and I'm sure you're thinking, Steph, this is pretty intense. This is too much chaos. I can't handle this much chaos. Yes, but I'm trying to tell you that if you can wrestle your words, if you can look at the jargon that you use, the conceptual framework, the matrix that you've trapped yourself in, that you've inherited from whatever litany of priests make up your modern environment, you stand a chance at beginning to pull yourself out of that web and start to see things clearly. And so what would be the correct way to go about a jargon crusade? You're looking for charged ideas. Instead of getting caught up in the chatter that most people get caught up in, you can dive down to the deep signal, avoid the noise, look at the first principles, the most charged ideas of all, and see how you can begin to reconstruct your mind and attune it better to reality so that you make better decisions. See you in a bit, boyos.